Coming up this hour on the Jefferson Exchange, remembering the track legend Steve Prefontaine. But first, when we're looking for the right neighborhood to settle down in and raise a family, we might ask around about the quality of local schools, how safe the area is, and what the neighbors are like. It turns out some birds also use word of mouth or song of mouth to decide where to raise their young. A recent study found that the singing of other nesting birds can be even more persuasive than the physical environment. The findings suggest that there's more to bird song than meets the ear. And joining us is Matthew Betts. He is the assistant professor at Oregon State University in the Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society, and joins us from his office in Portland. Matthew Betts, welcome, or rather in Corvallis. Matthew Betts, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you very much.
So what motivated you to study this particular study on bird communication?
Well, where animals end up, what they choose as habitat, is extremely important for their reproduction and survival, just as it is for humans. So understanding what cues they use or the actual criteria they use to settle is extremely important. So interestingly, despite its importance, very few people have actually looked at the cues animals use to determine where they're going to end up and end up breeding. So we chose a species of songbird just as a representation of migratory songbirds to see what criteria it might use.
So researchers played bird song recordings, and you sort of figured out that some of those recordings were saying that this is a great place to raise a family?
That's right. So traditionally, it's been thought that animals use what we call structural cues to settle. So they're using, for example, the number of big trees if you're a spotted owl, or they use the density of grassland stems if you're something like a savanna sparrow. And so we wanted to test the idea that birds are using more social information, as you pointed out in the introduction. And one hypothesis we had was that this actually could be song itself. And everyone knows that song is mainly used by songbirds to try and attract mates. Hey, baby, come over here, I'm sort of sexy, and also to defend territories. But no one has really looked to the extent to which other birds might eavesdrop on the sounds of these birds singing to determine that a site is high quality. So our study was a controlled and replicated experiment that pitted these two major ideas against each other, the idea that birds use vegetation cues, size of large trees, or social information, each other, and eavesdropping. So we set up song playback experiments in places where you really wouldn't expect to find the species that we are interested in. We put them in really young forest, and this species tends to be associated with old forest. And we did these playbacks of a male singing late in the breeding season during the time that it was having its young. So unexpectedly, the birds, well, we knew the birds would fly south for the winter. They go all the way to Central America for the winter. And the following spring, to somewhat our surprise, we had really high rates of settlement in these young forests where we'd done our playbacks, and you wouldn't normally have the species.
So you're saying that you played the recordings in a place where it would be bad judgment on the part of a bird to normally settle there.
That's
or decide
right.
to nest there.
Right.
So against what would have been their instinctual sort of sensibility, they decided to, and you figure it was because you've been playing these songs of attraction.
That's right. The only thing that was different about those sites to under natural conditions was our experimental treatment. So it had to be the fact that song was coming from these sites that attracted them there to settle in the following year.
Well, Matthew Betts is a professor and avian expert, avian ecologist at Oregon State University. We have a short recording here of a bird song. This is of the warbler, and we're just going to play this, and then you can tell us what we're hearing. So that's the sound of a warbler. Does that sound familiar? Is there a message, and what's the message there?
It does, but people should know that a lot of these songs don't transmit that well over the phone. The frequency gets truncated, so it's a little bit different to what people would experience in nature. But yeah, that's the Song of the Black-Throated Blue, and ornithologists tend to have mnemonics for these species. A lot of them sound similar to the uninitiated, but so we sort of come up with human words that reflect the song.
An interpretation of what that might mean.
I mean, that's exactly. A mnemonic is an interpretation. So if I was communicating to a colleague, I would say that bird was saying, zer, 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 z, zer, 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 z. So,
and mnemonically, that's one thing, but what is that, and how does that translate in terms of the message?
Well, now, the interesting thing about what we found was that it's not actually the characteristics of the song itself that's communicating the key information to these eavesdropping young birds looking for somewhere to settle. It's more the timing. So during the peak part of the breeding season, for example, now, it actually wouldn't mean very much to a young bird. But we did the playbacks late in the breeding season after these birds have bred. And it turns out that the ones that have bred successfully, that have had lots of young, are more likely to still be singing in the August or post-breeding period. So it's sort of a singing after success type thing. And the ones that are still singing are the ones that reproduced, and the eavesdroppers hear that and settle. So it's less to do with the actual characteristics of the song than it is the timing within the year.
Matthew Betts, we're going to take a quick break and come right back to you and talk about birds and bird nesting and some of the threats to birds and how you go about getting this information, recordings, cameras, that sort of thing. And Matthew Betts is an avian ecologist at Oregon State University. We welcome your comment or a question to him at 1-800-838-3760, or you can go online to jeffexchange.org. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. It's 36 past 8. I'm Keith Henty. And on the line with us from Corvallis, Oregon, is Matthew Betts. He is a bird ecologist there and teaches at Oregon State University in the Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society. And we're talking about a recent study about bird communication and how birds will kind of lure each other into perhaps a beneficial nesting area and say, hey, this is a good place to raise a family. And then they communicate at certain times of the year through certain types of bird songs. So one question I have is, how do you go about studying birds in this way? Is there specific recordings that you make and that you use video cameras?
We haven't really used video cameras very much except for monitoring nests. So we didn't use them in this particular study, but yes, the recordings are made fairly simply. We take a microphone with a big parabola around it to amplify the sound, and we take it into the forest and point it at the bird of interest while it sings and record it. And then we have actually a much more complicated system of speakers that we use for the actual experiment. And we put these in the young forest, and speakers about 20 meters apart, and we had these big batteries and timing systems enabled them to come on really early in the morning without us being there, and then play until about 3 in the afternoon for six days straight. So we had to actually carry these battery systems and playback systems deep into the forest, sometimes for kilometers, and set them there and then wait to see what happened.
Where was the forest?
The forest was actually in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. We're doing something similar here in Oregon now, but the study was conducted at the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest, which is an NSF-funded long-term ecological research site.
So back to the story of what happened. When you did this, you played these bird recordings, the songs, in the fall?
We played them in the late summer, that's right.
Late summer.
Yeah.
And basically what you thought you were playing was a message that other birds were hearing something like, this is a great place to raise a family.
That's right.
And then the result was the following, but this was in an area that they wouldn't normally be a good place.
That's the key point, right.
And so the next spring, you found that that birds were actually migrating there and building nests.
Well, now that's the interesting point. So initially, it's quite well known in this species that the males arrive before the females, generally by about 4 days. So at first we had these males settling in these sites that where they typically wouldn't occur, and that was sort of surprising. But the more surprising bit was that 4 days later, we actually had females pairing up with these males. We figured that once the birds arrived, maybe they would have figured that we tricked them.
What was wrong with the place?
The species is typically associated with really quite mature forest. It's not quite the spotted owl of the east, but it is a mature forest associate. So picture big eastern deciduous sugar maple and yellow birch with a big shrubby understory, and that's the typical species habitat for the species. So the places we did these playbacks had been cut as recently as 5 years previously and had none of those big trees, and in some cases almost no shrubs at all. So it wasn't quite as extreme as attracting a mature forest species into a parking lot, but it was awfully close. So you just naturalists in the east would know that you don't typically see the species in those sites.
What are the threats to birds and bird families?
Oh, there are a number of threats. Predators, obviously, some of the hawks there to the adults. But the major thing these birds are trying to avoid during the breeding season is having their nests depredated or their nests lost to predators. Adult survival on the breeding grounds is actually pretty high. It's the nest survival. It's actually terrible. If a bird initiates a nest, the chance of it actually being raised to fledging when the young leave is only about 50%. So they have to be very careful about where they select these sites.
What happens to the nests that don't survive, or the fledglings?
Well, generally they're the ones that are eaten by chipmunks or red squirrels, and sometimes snakes. And they're shrub nesters, so the nests aren't very high up. And actually, the reason we picked the species as a study species initially years ago was that the nests are quite easy for humans to find. So I assume that means that predators can find them fairly easily, too. And that's reflected in the very low nest survival rate.
You made a point earlier about the males arriving first on the scene, so to speak, and then females following into an area that wasn't necessarily good for nesting. It sort of sounds like the females were somehow too trusting of the males.
That's right. So we can't conclusively say that we're calling this an information cascade or some sort of glamorous, but really it's just that the females might have been in turn tricked by the males who settled there. And you're right, possibly just too trusting. And one other possibility is that the females actually saw our treatments the previous year, and they thought it was a good site too and decided to settle. But generally, it's thought that the females tend to settle based on the quality of the male there, actually. So the male selects the site, he uses these cues that we provided, and then the female looks for a high-quality male, and she settles with him. So the unknown in this is that we actually weren't able to find nests in these sites, and we don't know whether that means that they didn't actually try to nest, or whether some of these sites were extremely thick and difficult to search, and we didn't have a lot of resources to look for nests. So we don't know whether they nested. I sort of suspect that if they did nest, they might not have been that successful. Otherwise, the species would occur in these sites naturally. So we did a bit of a mean trick for the sake of science in this case. We delayed breeding probably for these species until either way later in the year or the following year. But under natural conditions, this becomes a really efficient way for birds to find the best habitat. And that's the exciting part about it. It means that, you know, as climate changes or as the landscape changes due to human activity, there's some possibility that some of these young birds can keep pace with it by learning a little bit from their peers.
This is sort of a equivalent of a follow the leader, or kind of a specialized real estate sort of agent saying, you know, the best place for your family is over here.
That's right.
And here's something that has changed. In other words, that's now a bad neighborhood.
Exactly. And the only twist being that it's inadvertent. So rather than having a real estate being sort of friendly and helping you find somewhere to live, you're just sort of watching somebody to see if they're enjoying themselves at a site. And then you're going to try.
Oh, it's not a direct message, you're saying. It's sort of like the birds are actually noticing and paying attention, or hearing that, Other birds are just having a good time.
That's right.
It's safe there.
That's right.
So they're actually sort of eavesdropping.
Exactly, yeah.
And again, how is this sort of useful to, in the advent of say, climate change or some other, you know, if there's a clear cut?
Well, so I don't think the results of our particular context are that useful for climate change, but the mechanism we're showing is really important. So, and imagine the alternative that I pointed out in the intro was that these species are picking out particular structures to do with the forest that indicate good nesting habitat. So say you have a species that cues in on, say, large Douglas fir trees, and that's what it considers to be good habitat. And now the climate changes, actually. So this type of forest actually isn't necessarily that good for the species. The problem is, if they have that shortcut, big trees equals good habitat, it's not going to be changing to reflect the actual change in underlying habitat quality. So you could have a situation where an animal is continually trying to breed at a site, it's actually poor quality. But if they're cueing in on members of the same species or their elders, they can more rapidly make the decision. As soon as a bird fails and doesn't succeed to produce young in that particular forest type, it'll become readily apparent to the young, and they'll try going somewhere else.
Does this apply to other species, other animals?
Well, and that's the fascinating part. We're in the process of trying to understand whether it does. It's just becoming apparent over the last 5 years or so that a number of animals, and it probably should have been obvious to us in the scientific community, but it wasn't, that a number of animals use conspecifics, members of the same species, in their settlement decisions. It just hadn't been shown before how extreme that decision-making is, and that we could actually completely flip the habitat association of the species. So people have shown that, for example, antelopes in Africa are actually cueing in on high-quality habitat in the savanna by smelling the urine of reproductively successful females. This is a paper in Nature about 5 or 6 years ago. So young antelopes are actually cueing in on a high-quality site by paying attention to what the reproductively successful females are doing. Another study in Europe showed the species of cavity nesting bird, so a bird that lives in little holes in trees. They manipulated the number of young in nests under the idea that if there were lots of young in a hole, it should indicate high-quality site. If there were very few young in a hole, it should be a low-quality site. And consistent with their prediction, they actually had higher rates of settlement at the places where they'd added young into the holes, which I found to be pretty fascinating.
Matthew Betts, thank you very much for being on The Exchange.
Thank you.
Matthew Betts is an assistant professor at Oregon State University in the Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society. We reached him at his office in Corvallis. The discovery that he's talking about, the study on migratory songbirds, was recently published in a professional journal called Proceedings of the Royal Society B, and scientists from OSU, along with other collaborators, contributed to that study.